Tawa playfully shouted, while gently knocking on the door and laughing to himself. Tony? Finally, Harmon poked his head out the door. Mr. A? What are you doing here?
I heard you have something special to show me, Arakawa replied. But first, I must ask why my keycard does not work.
Oh, that, Harmon said with a sheepish grin. I never thought you'd want to come in, but since you're here, let me show you around. Physically, Nintendo's treehouse did not quite live up to its name. It was a nearly 2,000 square foot area with a few 4 foot high cubicles, a small conference room, and an L-shaped bench in the back of the office. But a closer look revealed that, philosophically, it was everything an adult treehouse should be. Beside those cubicles, there were some old arcade cabinets hanging in the conference room where storyboards of games to be, and piled on that bench in the back was a pyramid of hardware systems. It was a fun place to work, no doubt, but there was lots of work to be done. This new space was where NOA now localized NCL's Japanese games, reviewed third-party titles, and for Tony Harmon, as well as his external producers Ken Lobb and Brian Ulrich, it was a place to develop games without constantly being asked, "What you working on?" After a quick tour of the treehouse, Harmon showed Arakawa what he had come to see. The game that Rare had been working on. It was still about 10 to 12 months from completion, and didn't even have a name. Its codename was Country, because Rare Studio was located on the English countryside. But the Stamper brothers had been doing such an incredible job at the game that Harmon wanted his boss to have a look. When Arakawa finally sat down and watched a demo of the game, he looked like he had seen a ghost. And in many ways, he had. Because what Arakawa saw was the hulking body of an old friend, one who had been defeated by Mario so many years earlier. 13 years ago, this character had rescued Nintendo of America from obscurity, and now he was back again to haunt the competition. After all these years, the wonderful beast had returned. Donkey Kong.
This is incredible, Arakawa declared. The 64-bit games will look this good?
What do you mean? Harmon asked.
Do you expect many of the games will appear in this quality on Ultra 64?
Oh, Harmon said, pleasantly taken aback. No, Mr. A, this game is for the Super Nintendo. The look on Arakawa's face was equal to incredible multiplied by impossible. This game, which would later be called Donkey Kong Country, was only 16 bits? Summer CES 1994 was only 6 weeks away, but Arakawa was convinced that it was worth undoing everything to feature this and only this. Don James, who designed Nintendo's fantastical display, would later be asked to make this change and somehow, in only a matter of weeks, create a 30,000-square-foot booth with a volcanic island flaming in the middle. Thousands would come to marvel at this amazing game, the one that would extend the lifespan of the SNES and prove that Nintendo could rise back to the top without needing to rely on violence, name-calling, or flashy marketing. Make no mistake, there would be tons of marketing for the game. Peter Main, George Harrison, and Perrin Kaplan would be allowed to go to town. The difference was just that, unlike their competitor, there would be substance behind the style. Normally, Arakawa's initial order for a game that Nintendo deemed to be an A-plus title was 1 million units, but for Donkey Kong Country, he ordered 4 million right off the bat. This is what Nintendo had been waiting for, after all, and it was finally time for the tortoise to open the war chest and strap on a jetpack. Did it take longer than Arakawa expected for Nintendo to make their big move? Maybe. But he was not at all surprised that the time had finally arrived. The only thing that surprised him in the end was that inside of the tortoise shell, there was a gorilla hidden inside.
Tony?
Yes?
You did good.
Thank you, Mr. A. Anytime. Chapter 60 Kings of the Jungle. In a continued effort to reclaim the fun, and in honor of what Nintendo hoped would be a game-changing surprise, the guys in Redmond decided to do something a little different for the 1994 Summer CES. Instead of just writing a straightforward speech for Peter Main or Howard Lincoln, Don Varryu scripted an elaborate skit to perform in front of developers, distributors, and retailers on June 23, 1994. And to finally usher Nintendo out of its dark ages, the performance fittingly began in complete and utter darkness.
Randy, how much further do we have to go?
Relax, Bruce. The map says we're almost there.
A tiny halo of light appears, and then another. So small it's hard to determine the source, until Nintendo's Bruce Donaldson and Randy Parrotsman move through the audience on their way toward the stage.
You hear them say these marketing guys are pretty far out and out of touch with reality, but this is really far out. We're in the middle of no place.
Nope. No place at all.
Some lights turn on, still dim but with a bright auburn hue, and the intrepid explorers Donaldson and Parrotsman are revealed to be dressed in full safari gear.
You know, I bet there's not a dry martini within 1,000 miles of this place.
Shh! There's the tent right over there.
The stage becomes fully lit, revealing an elaborate campsite in the middle of nowhere. And then from the tent emerges Peter Mayne, a cigar dangling between his lips with just the right amount of nonchalance.
Hey, hey! Aren't you a sight for sore eyes?
George Harrison steps out of the tent next, and then Nintendo's powers all shake hands.
Dr. Livingwell, I presume?
Life has its ups and downs. Whoever said you couldn't make the best of a bad deal? Come here and sit down for a minute.
You know, Randy, we have almost everything we need here. And anything that we want to hear from the States, we have all this equipment.
Harrison tilts his head toward electrical thingamajigs and a large television screen.
George has been working on this for 5 or 6 months, but the only problem is that we don't get any sports news. So Bruce, tell me, the Sonics really did go all the way, didn't they?
The audience breaks out in laughter.
Man, you're completely out of touch with reality. It must be the heat out here.
Heat? Try running the marketing department. You get a second-degree burn these days just answering the phone.
The audience breaks out in laughter again, genuine this time.
That's why we left. The guys in Japan were screaming, the guys in Redmond were screaming, the reps were raising hell. Man, it was time to clear out and go to ground.
So this is the solution? To run away from it all?
Brucey, running away? You gotta understand, we're not running away from anything. We just decided to come out here on a little hunting trip. As a matter of fact, there's some of those little suckers again.
Mayne grabs a shotgun and fires twice, and suddenly a bloodied image of Sonic the Hedgehog appears on the large TV. The crowd loves it. This is so precisely their humor. And Peter Mayne picks up a nearby martini as he basks in the adoration.
And that's what you're after? Flying hedgehogs?
Only in a manner of speaking, my good man. That's just the small stuff. Let me put it this way. You remember it was about 10 years ago when Nintendo took its first trip out here to the video game jungle, looking for that beast that would put us back on the map? What we came up with 10 years ago was that big ape called Donkey Kong, who took us from a single coin-op machine to a company doing over $100 million in just a couple of months. Well, we're on the same kind of hunt again, and we're gonna find that next group of 800-pound gorillas, and I mean big, hairy, muscular games. And I gotta tell you, this expedition is right on track. It's leading us back to where we belong as undisputed king of the jungle.
Peter Mayne smiles, nods, and slides the cigar back into his mouth.
Yeah, I heard that before, but I gotta tell you, Peter, a lot of people back in the States think that Nintendo and this whole business is going right down the river. I mean, we all knew it was going to be a transition year, but nobody thought we were going to see numbers like this.
Well, no question it's become a real jungle. The competition's out there like a bunch of drunken head shrinkers. I mean, there's a whole group out there saying every day that the current technology is tired and over. But let's not lose sight of the big picture, guys. First of all, this video game industry ain't small potatoes.
A graphic appears on the television, indicating the industry has grown to $15 billion worldwide, $6 billion in the United States.
And secondly, yeah, Nintendo had a bad year. I mean, what the heck? Sales dropped, profits dropped, but we still made $500 million in profit. which was about 5 times what that other guy made, because as he ran around the world trying to buy market share, he gave it all away and ended up barely breaking even. It dawns on the audience almost all at once that this is more than just a silly skit. It's a satire about the war between Sega and Nintendo. And finally, I gotta tell you, the future is gonna be bright. I mean, look at all those big strategic thinkers who are standing in line. AT&T, Sony, Panasonic, JVC, even that guy Spielberg over there in Hollywood, all waiting to get into this business. Can't be so bad.
You guys look awfully calm for the predicament you're in.
Peter Main suavely removes the cigar from his mouth. And at that point, it must also dawn on the audience that Main should never be without a cigar. It just fits him so well. Well, Bruce, old buddy, you're right. 20 points ain't exactly chopped liver, but you gotta be patient. Be patient a little bit. First of all, this is June, and we still got over 2/3 of the business year ahead of us. And I gotta tell you, we're going to make some really big things happen over these next 6 months. So why don't you just cool your jets a little bit? I mean, sit back, relax, have a drink. We've got some real reason for optimism. And to start out with, I want to have my good man George of the Jungle here fill you in on a couple of discoveries he's made since we're out here. And believe me, it's going to help you relax. With a spear in hand, Harrison proudly talks about an amazing discovery he made one day while wandering through the outback. It was the lost temple of Pac-Man. Apparently, it was a sacred cave that had been accidentally covered over when the natives started building condos. But even so, I found a way inside, and there before me was the secret to the lost civilizations of video games. There before me were the carcasses of Atari and Coleco, and there stood a magic cauldron, still at a full boil. Once I looked at it, I knew exactly what it was. A native crystal ball with all the secrets of the video game industry. What were you smoking in there? What the cauldron said was exactly what we'd been hearing for months in our own market research. I asked the cauldron what the players want, and every few seconds, not surprisingly, the answer was good games. But then came a group of answers that probably, in hindsight, shouldn't have surprised us. They not only wanted great games, but also wanted to be associated with a system that makes them feel cool. They want to be associated with hardware that's advanced and up to date. In short, they wanted fun, and they wanted image. So I asked, what does all this mean for the Super NES? And the cauldron boiled for a while, and it got cloudy. It was clear there was work to be done. That's right. And that was all the information we needed to get started in a whole new direction. The first thing we did was to set out to try and find a stronger Nintendo message and even stronger delivery. Our TV campaigns have to be outrageous, and they have to be seen in more places than ever before. Places that even your reps might see them. And at the same time, you're going to see an explosion of Nintendo ads in the gaming magazines. We decided once and for all to break our competitors' lock on that key media. Harrison then goes on to talk about everything that the new, post-denial Nintendo has in store for the months ahead. Bigger events, better communication, and a recommitment to the fun that made Nintendo a household name. I know this is a real change of attitude, but we can't afford to miss out anymore. And just like that, Nintendo awakens and finds a balance between the tortoise and the hare. Slow and deliberate, friendly and flashy. Finally, we decided to get some street smarts on the whole violence issue. Is there a market out there for more sophisticated games? Of course. So we'll accept the ability of a rating system to allow the consumers to make informed choices. From now on, we'll see no repeats of the Mortal Kombat incident, where we saw customers buy what they thought was a more attractive product from our competitor. Those days are behind us. We'll modify the internal guidelines, and I can tell you now that Mortal Kombat 2 will be the same whether it's on our platform or anyone else's. And cunning. Always cunning. With the newly created ratings board, Nintendo now had a built-in bunker in which it could duck for cover. Hey, Isn't that all right? I mean, thanks, George. All that good stuff, now that's quite a start.
Thunderous applause takes hold of the room. To his left and to his right, everyone applauded except for him. Al Nilsen was impressed by the performance, which exuded an almost Sonic-worthy level of cleverness. But he knew all too well that words were only that. Had Nintendo really learned from its mistakes? Had they finally awoken? Would they really be able to merge that long-term stay-the-course attitude with the short-term shifts of this post-Sega world? Nilsen was skeptical, but less so about 10 minutes later when Don Coyner, Nintendo's director of advertising, appeared on stage to discuss the company's new marketing campaign.
"Look who I found thrashing around the swamp," George Harrison said, introducing the cameo. "It's Don Coyner, and he said he had a revelation out there."
"Don, I didn't know you were out here," Donaldson added. "What are you doing in the middle of the jungle?"
"Well," Coyner began with a long-overdue twinkle in his eye, "I got so tired of all those retailers and sales reps complaining about Nintendo's advertising that I decided to come out here and fix it for myself."
Finally, Coyner thought, as he finally had the opportunity to speak these words. Finally, finally, finally. After spending a large, stressful portion of the past few years trying to convince Arakawa, Lincoln, and Maine to let Nintendo to take off the gloves, tastefully, of course, they were finally willing to do something different. There were a variety of reasons that Nintendo is now willing to spruce things up, but the straw that broke the camel's back turned out literally to be a camel. In late 1993, Coyner initiated a series of research studies in which gamers were given a stack of 20 pictures depicting animals and then asked to use these images to answer a series of questions about video games. Questions like, which animals best represent Nintendo and which ones best represent Sega? The results were nearly unanimous. Cheetahs, gazelles, and other speedy creatures were associated with Sega, whereas elephants, camels, and other slow movers supposedly embodied Nintendo. Arakawa was normally distrustful of focus groups and marketing data, but something about the images made a dent this time, and that enabled Coyner to move forward with what he was now about to unveil.
"Kids want more excitement from our advertising, but the answer was not to imitate the competition. We have to do them one better," he said, and with that he introduced Nintendo's Play It Loud campaign.
On the surface, Play It Loud appeared to be exactly what Coyner had claimed it would not, a Sega ripoff. With quicker cuts, louder music, and an aggressive feeling, it had much in common with its competitor spots. But upon closer examination, that wasn't quite the case. The colors were still bright, the game footage was still plentiful, and although there was mischief, there was also a sense of optimism.
"We're going to give the kids an anthem," Coyner proudly explained. "One that says, you can't be young forever, so live it large, live it free, and play it loud."
"Good, but not great," Nilsen thought.
But even with his high standards, he couldn't help but echo Coyner's sentiment. Finally. Nintendo should have done this, or something like it, several years ago. But better late than never, right? "Anyway," Peter Main said, stepping in, "when Arakawa and Lincoln sent us out into the jungle, they said they weren't going to take no for an answer. They wanted to know if we could put behind us this lily-white image on game content. Well, I think we've just shown that the answer to that is yes." Tattered applause swept through the room, but still nothing from Nilsen. That guy was a tough one to please. "Then, of course, there are the games," Maine continued. "It's no secret we were weak on this in the second half of last year, and yes, Griffey and Metroid have started to turn the tide, but they're not enough. We thought we'd found a great combination of old and new, but when we unloaded the cages back in Redmond, the response was, 'Gee, that's terrific, but it ain't enough, and don't you come back home until you get one more drop-dead-in-your-tracks killer attraction.' They reminded me that 10 years ago they shook the entire country with the big feat of Donkey Kong. Can't you guys go out there and find us that one huge hit that will once more make Nintendo undisputed king of the jungle?" And so, that's exactly what we did.
Maine took a couple of steps closer to the audience, finding his rhythm, and then appearing to near a crescendo to this whole performance. "Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to introduce you to the eighth wonder of the video game world, the best game ever created by Nintendo or anyone else, the new stunning industry breakthrough, Donkey Kong Country!" With these words, Peter Mayne introduced a clip of the atomic bomb Nintendo needed to turn the tide in its war with Sega. A game that never would have existed had Tony Harmon not willed it into existence on the basis of the scenario he'd presented to Yamauchi of one less bad commercial. This was it. The true game changer that both returned Nintendo to their roots and also took them one step ahead. Nintendo was back. And as everyone in the room went wild with applause, this time Nilsson was the loudest of them all.
"Bravo,"
Kmart senior buyer said 2 days later as he approached Peter Mayne at Nintendo's booth. Although he was a famously difficult man to please, on this day, his face was filled with nothing but pleasantries.
"Well, hello there, old friend," Mayne said with an easygoing grin. "I'll take a bravo whenever I can get one, but to what do I owe the honor?"
"Where do I even begin?"
the buyer from Kmart replied, forcing a chuckle.
"But really, that game you all showed off at the presentation, it's out of this world."
"It's something else, isn't it?"
"It's gonna put you guys back on top."
"Whoa now," Mayne cautioned. "One thing at a time."
"No, I mean it,"
the buyer declared.
"And in the spirit of putting my money where my mouth is, Kmart is ready to make a very serious commitment."
Before Mayne even realized what was happening, several Kmart employees emerged from the trade show's hubbub and stepped forward with a large check mounted on a plywood frame. The check was made out to Nintendo of America for $32 million.
"We'd like to officially place an order for 1 million units,"
Kmart senior buyer announced.
"What do you say?"
For moments, Mayne was speechless. Not only was the gesture wonderfully surprising, but selling a quantity like this right off the bat would make Donkey Kong Country one of the best-selling games of 1994. It would also give them enormous momentum going into the Christmas season. The game would be released in November, and almost single-handedly propel Nintendo back past Sega.
"I think you know exactly what I'm going to say," Mayne said, that grin still sliding across his face.
"This is a terrific gesture, and I'm truly honored, but there ain't no way we can allocate that much product to you guys. Let me crunch the numbers with my guys back in Redmond, and I'll get back to you with what Kmart's allocation will be.
How does that sound?"
How did it sound?
Well, it sounded like although the video game industry had dramatically changed these past few years, Nintendo was still the same. Dedicated to great quality, and even greater quality control. Chapter 61. And then there were three.
"Come one, come all,"
Stretch Anderson proclaimed, poking his head out from the first class partition.
"And see the amazing, outstanding Mr. Steve Race."
Stretch Anderson, Sony's newest director of operations, was a lanky man by nature, and he seemed even lankier when he was on an airplane. He made his way down the aisle in economy class to see who wanted to speak with the man behind the curtain. He waved for one of the eager faces to come forward.
"You'll have 10 minutes with the man,"
Anderson said, ushering the stranger toward the first-class seating.
"And not a minute more."
As soon as he scooted the gentleman past the partition, he turned around and looked for the next person to poach. The flight was packed, mostly full of guys who were heading back to California after a week spent at the 1994 summer CES in Chicago. That made Anderson's job even easier. All these employees from Sega and West Coast developers, it was like shooting fish in a barrel.
"All right, who wants to go next?"
Several hands shot into the air, all of them hoping for 10 minutes with the great Oz at Sony, and if those minutes went well, maybe a job offer. It wasn't so much that these people on the flight were unhappy with their current jobs, but Sony was offering big money, and based on the recently released hardware specs, people had begun to take the PSX seriously. Ken Kutaragi's masterpiece had dazzled at the Consumer Electronics Show. It was the world's first true 3D console, and able to process 360,000 polygons per second.
In addition to the technical specifications, there was another surprising reason to get behind Sony. The software. Like Tom Kalinske and Peter Main before him, Olufsen realized that the key to selling hardware lay in the software. But unlike Sega and Nintendo, Sony lacked an arcade pedigree and would struggle greatly to churn out first-party titles. Therefore, the secret to Sony's success would hinge on successfully recruiting third-party developers. This is why Olufsen's overpaying for Psygnosis had absolutely been worth it. Not only did the acquisition help stabilize Sony's first-party roster, but the tech-savvy studio created an easy-to-use development kit with the intention of enticing developers to favor Sony over Sega, whose kit was said to be extremely complicated, and Nintendo, who is notoriously stingy with providing development tools. That was one way that Olufsen hoped to inspire a lemming-like following toward Sony. The other was Electronic Arts, the same company that way back had hoisted skeptics onto Sega's bandwagon. Olufsen and Jim Whims, SCEA's newly appointed VP of sales, made a deal with EA's CEO Larry Probst. If EA could provide 5 titles in time for the launch, then for the lifetime of the console, they would only pay a $2 royalty, as opposed to the standard toll of $10. Another sweetheart deal for Electronic Arts, and this time, they didn't even have to reverse engineer a console. Sony had slowly been building an army over the past few years, and now that people had started to pay attention, they were stunned by how formidable the force appeared to be. "Who else wants in?" Anderson asked, making his rounds. Several hands rose, the faces below them revealing whimsical excitement and no trace of remorse.
"Maybe you should think about leaving, too,"
Michael Milken suggested to Kalinske when they met for lunch in the summer of 1994.
"Come join Larry and me. You'd be an absolutely perfect fit."
"That's flattering," Kalinske said, allowing himself for a moment to consider the possibility. Michael Milken, the renowned junk bond kingpin who had celebrated the 80s by shaking up Wall Street, which led to his starting off the 90s by serving 22 months in prison, was now a free man, and he wanted to do something good with his life. No, something great. And like Kalinske, he'd always had tremendous passion for combining education with technology, which had led him to start a new company with his brother and Oracle CEO Larry Ellison, which did just that.
"I've talked about it with Larry," Milken explained, "and we'd really like for you to run it. What do you think?"
Milken had admired his lunch date ever since the two met in the early 80s, but it was something Kalinske had done at the end of the decade that really got his attention. On April 23, 1989, when the country was busy blaming its financial problems on a recently indicted Michael Milken, Kalinske wrote an op-ed to the Los Angeles Times declaring that the U.S. government should have given Michael Milken a commendation and gold medal for the help he's provided our country's economy instead of indicting him. That was the kind of thing someone never forgets, and it further convinced Milken that Kalinske was the right guy to run his new venture.
"What do I think?" Kalinske asked. "Sounds great. Absolutely fantastic, but I can't leave Sega. Especially not now."
"Why not? You said it's a sinking ship."
"I said it feels like a sinking ship," Kalinske corrected. "That doesn't mean things can't be fixed. Plus, even if the ship sinks, I should be there to go down with it."
"A martyr?"
"Hardly. I owe it to my company and the employees."
"How is that not being a martyr?"
Kalinske gave this a moment of consideration.
"Because in the video game industry, nobody cares about history. I'll just be the guy who was there for the fall. No one will remember anything before that."
"Hmm," Milken said, trying to decide whether to continue pushing.
"Sounds to me like all the more reason to get out of there."
"You're probably right, but..."
"You're not changing my mind," Kalinske said, before falling into a smile. "At least, not yet."
"So," Peter Main wondered aloud, with a grin befitting his befuddled excitement,
"does anyone have half a clue about how the hell this is supposed to work?"
"Hardly,"
Howard Lincoln said, also sporting a dangerously excited grin.
"But I'm feeling rather confident that we'll all be able to figure this out."
"Yes," Minoru Arakawa added with a soft blink of his eyes, which roughly translated to mean, "We always do, don't we?"
It was October 19th, 1994, and Nintendo of America's three amigos were bracing themselves to boldly go where no video game executives had gone before. Cyberspace. 6 days earlier, NOA had announced that in an effort to make Donkey Kong Country the biggest game ever, Nintendo would become the first video game to utilize online technology for a new product launch. Nintendo's three-month online campaign would be available exclusively on CompuServe, the leading worldwide internet service with 2.3 million members. To attract attention and bridge the gap between corporation and consumer, the campaign would kick off with a live one-hour chat hosted by Arakawa, Lincoln, and Maine. "Now, what I'd like to know," Maine mused, "is after we post a reply, how will it know that we're done with that question and on to the next one?"
"Don't worry," assured Ron Lux, CompuServe systems operator, SysOp, who had come out to Redmond to moderate the conversation. "There's some lingo that we'll use to keep everything running smoothly, so just sit back, relax, and do what you all do best."
Lux looked at his watch, the seconds ticking down to 6 p.m. "Ready?" Nearly 10 years earlier, Arakawa, Lincoln, and Maine were plotting how to get a product nobody had ever heard of into stores everywhere. Slowly at first, and then quickly as credibility grew, these men succeeded in spectacular fashion. Inch by inch, they willed their way into more than 20,000 stores, and Nintendo products were available in just about every retail space imaginable. But now, there was a whole new space to think about. One that was much harder to imagine because it didn't physically exist. It was there, but it was not. It was everywhere and nowhere at the same time. The technocrats spoke about the internet as if it were a foregone conclusion, and maybe it would be. But it was hard to accept this certainty and not wonder what happened to that foregone conclusion of multimedia. What about virtual reality, or any of the other next big things that so quickly shrunk into extinction over the years? Maybe the internet would catch on, or maybe it would be the latest casualty in the graveyard of foregone conclusions, but either way, Nintendo would be there. Those days of wait and see were over, allowing scrappy go-getters take what should have been their own. Arakawa, Lincoln, and Maine were ready to look forward, not out of panic or desperation, but with the same thing that always propelled them forward: patience, persistence, and the numerical beauty of a well-calculated risk. Today a new quest began, a journey into the beyond. And just as they had done before, they set out to slowly take over this intangible new space, inch by theoretical inch. "Ready?" Lincoln repeated to himself. "Always and never." Arakawa and May nodded, signaling to Lux that they were ready to get started with whatever came next. "The Nintendo of America conference is beginning. Welcome, everyone. On behalf of CompuServe and the Video Game Publishers Forum, I would like to welcome our members to the first Nintendo online conference. My name is Ron Lux, and I'll be the moderator for tonight's conference. Now I'd like to introduce our three guests of honor. First is Mr. Minoru Arakawa, who serves as president of Nintendo of America. His screen name will be Mr. A. Next is Howard Lincoln, who joined Nintendo as senior vice president in 1983 and was appointed chairman of NOA in February 1994. Screen name Howard. And last but not least, we have Peter Maine, who has directed all sales and marketing activities for Nintendo products since 1987. Screen name Peter. Before we open up for questions, I'd like to introduce Howard Lincoln and have him provide a quick introduction to Donkey Kong Country and its new technology. Howard, GA, go ahead.
"First, Ron, on behalf of Minoru Arakawa and Peter Maine, I'd like to let everyone know how excited we are to be here tonight. Conversing online is a new concept, and we are looking forward to communicating using this new medium. Needless to say, we're very excited about this new game, which in our estimation will set the gold standard for 16-bit gameplay. We've been able to take the computer graphics technology that brought the dinosaurs to life in Jurassic Park and put it into a 16-bit video game. We call this process advanced computer modeling, and the results are outstanding."
"Thanks, Howard.
So, without any further delay, let me open the floor to the first question. And remember, to get in line to ask a question, type /QUE. Moderator recognizes question number one from Christian Mueller.
DKC has superb graphics, but we've seen such gameplay before. Do you think the consumer will accept old games even when they have superior graphics? GA.
Thank you for asking us about this. This is a brand new Donkey Kong game. Not only are the graphics superior, but the gameplay is outstanding in each of 100 levels. The gameplay is outstanding. GA.
Moderator recognizes question number two from Jer Horowitz.
This conference is a wonderful idea. Thanks for doing it. I remember when I first saw DKC at the Summer CES show. My writers and I were all astonished that it was an SNES game. I'm wondering, what will the next game be to use the ACM technology? GA.
That's a good question. Uniracers, coming on December 12th, also utilizes ACM technology to generate over 8,000 frames of animation. We also have other games currently in development, which you will hear more about shortly. GA.
The online chat continued for nearly an hour,
and ended with the question that everyone under 18 had been wondering since first picking up a Nintendo controller.
Moderator recognizes question number 23 from Chocobo.
Ever since Nintendo started the revolution that changed video games from a hobby to an industry, I've seriously wanted to work for you people. Who do I contact for more info? I'm there, dude. Play it loud. GA.
All three gentlemen laughing.
We're always looking for talented people. So just drop us a line, attention Bev Mitchell, and we'll be right back to you.
A nice note to end the conference. Thanks for your questions. I would once again like to thank Minoru Arakawa, Howard Lincoln, and Peter Main for joining us tonight. We enjoyed having you online.
Thank you, Ron. On behalf of Mr. Arakawa and Peter, I'd also like to thank the conference participants. We've enjoyed being online with all of you and look forward to doing this again. GA.
Before we sign off, I'd like to remind everyone of some additional Nintendo activities going on during the next few weeks. Starting on Monday, October 24th, video clips in both Mac and Windows formats will be available for downloading from our online Nintendo promotional area, Go Nintendo. This will include never-before-seen footage. Also starting next week, we'll be holding a Donkey Kong trivia contest. The grand prize winner will get an all-expense-paid trip to Nintendo. Donkey Kong Country game packs and other prizes will be awarded. Consult the contest details in the promotional area. Then, on November 8th, Nintendo will host another online conference with the video game designers and technicians behind Donkey Kong Country. Here's your chance to get the inside track on the development of a video game. Good night, everybody. Thanks for attending. The conference has ended.
What about now? Milken asked again at the end of 1994. Are you ready to allow yourself to enjoy working again?
Nope. Not yet, Kalinske said, noticeably less optimistic than he had been before. With no autonomy when it came to hardware, he focused even more on trumpeting Sega software. This had always been the primary focus, but Kalinske could sense the inklings of desperation. Decent games were marketed like they were good ones. The good games were launched like they were the greatest thing ever, and because Sega was now supporting so many platforms, the software was more and more being rushed to market. Kalinske was beginning to feel like a prisoner, locked in a cell by Sega of Japan. And he couldn't help but laugh at the irony when he, Ryo, and Toyota were dressed in prison stripes to promote the release of Sonic and Knuckles at a video game competition held in Alcatraz. He had tried to remain upbeat, and most of the time he continued to find a way. But on November 24th, 1994, those bubbles of hope seemed to burst all at once. That was the day when Sega released the 32X and Nintendo released Donkey Kong Country, which perfectly epitomized the different approaches between the two companies. Sega offered another new gizmo, which was expensive and would require entirely new software, which had been hard to get developers to make because Sega just had too many different systems. Nintendo offered a breakthrough game in the middle of the console's life cycle,
which not only reinvigorated the SNES, but hinted that there would be more like this going forward. Although the 32X would lose momentum rather quickly, Sega's reputation and market prowess had managed to create large demand for the launch, but even this caused a problem for Sega internally and externally. SOA had rushed the 32X to market in order to meet Nakayama-san's Christmas deadline, but SOJ had failed to produce the requested number of units. SOA had wanted 1 million, but SOJ, who refused to relinquish the hardware manufacturing responsibilities, only provided 400,000 units. Not only did this upset the underserviced retailers, but it made the launch look weak, which became something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. For the first time since Kalinske took over the company, a Sega product was met with mediocre reviews. He took no comfort in watching the failure of something he had said would fail. Instead, he chose to keep fighting for his team. That meant putting all his eggs into Sega Saturn's basket. The hardware was lousy and developers were shying away, but Kalinske felt like SOA's marketing muscle could turn this into something special, something that would even outdo Sonic Tuesday. So his team decided that on September 2, 1995, they would launch the console on what they now called Sega Saturn Day, shooting for the biggest console launch ever and gathering the kind of momentum that 32X had sorely missed. Meanwhile, Nintendo was living not in the future, but fully in the moment. The launch of Donkey Kong Country was the most successful in video game history, selling more than 7 million copies in only 6 months and helping Nintendo reclaim Christmas. Additionally, Nintendo had taken a page out of Sega's playbook and launched their Play It Loud marketing campaign, which beautifully merged Nintendo's straight arrow mentality with Sega's edgy attitude. This was a blow to Sega, but what Nintendo was doing on the marketing front hardly compared to what Sony was up to. With Race and Anderson in charge, the plan was to continue to push the envelope further than Sega ever had. Edgier, wackier, cooler. Under Kalinske, Sega had indeed slain Nintendo and was the new king. So Race wanted to position Sega the same way that Sega had once positioned Nintendo. As the lame establishment that had forgotten how to have fun. Sony started running competitive ads against Sega. If you buy a Saturn, then your head must be up Uranus. This was the first time in Race's career that he'd worked for a company so flush with cash, and he was having the time of his life doing anything and everything he wanted. It's like having money in high school, he'd been heard to say, and the confidence he exuded made him a shoo-in for Homecoming King. "But I can't stand to see you like this," Michael Milken said to his friend. "When did you become a masochist?"
"A masochist?" Kalinske asked. "So I'm not a martyr anymore?"
"A man can be both," Milken explained.
Kalinske shook his head.
"It's not that, Michael, but I just can't go ahead and give up here. There's too much at stake. And as long as we do something big with the new system, then it'll be like all this stress never happened."
"But I thought you said it's no good."
"I'm not a technical guy. What the hell do I know?" Kalinske asked. "So it doesn't have the right number of polygons or whatnot. As long as we have the right games and the right messaging, then it could work."
"The right messaging?" Milken laughed.
"Just when I think you're an okay guy, you remind me that you're still a marketing maven through and through."
Kalinske shrugged. "It's all just telling stories." And the story that Sega needed to tell now was that its players were even younger and hipper than Sony's crowd. This led Kalinske to make a tough decision and find a new athlete to become the face of Sega Sports and the center of the sub-brand's football franchise. Although this effectively ended his personal and professional relationship with Joe Montana, Kalinske felt like it was the right thing to do. But it was hard to feel good about the transition as Fournassier reluctantly passed along negative reports about Montana's replacement, Deion Sanders. Montana was unanimously described by those he worked with as a class act, while everyone who came into contact with Sanders described working with him as a nightmare. He didn't show up at meetings, wouldn't speak directly to those he was working with. His preferred form of communication was through his entourage. And when he did speak, it was always in the third person. But Sega had no choice but to put up with him. He was the face of Sega Sports for the beginning of the new console war.
"All right," Milken said. "You're not there yet, but let's keep talking, okay?"
"Sure," Kalinske said.
Even a marketing maven is wise enough to realize it would be foolish to turn down free sessions of flattery and therapy. Kalinske had not yet reached his breaking point, but Steve Race did everything in his power to push him there.
"Relax, Tom. It's just a joke," Race said, putting an arm around Kalinske's shoulder.
They were in Las Vegas for the 1995 Winter Consumer Electronics Show, which would be the last one that Sega ever attended. Thank God, just about everyone thought. After all the years that the CES treated video games like the fad, they didn't turn out to be. Going forward, the video game industry would have its own trade show, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, E3, the first of which would take place on May 15th of that year in Los Angeles. This was the direct result of the Video Game Trade Association that Kalinske had spearheaded, and it was there that Sega, Sony, and Nintendo would all unveil their next-generation consoles. But that still lay in the future. Today, Kalinske had awakened in Vegas to find himself a victim of the latest prank from the guys at Sony. Apparently, in the middle of the night, all of the Sonic memorabilia displayed throughout the hotel where he was staying had been defaced. Displays torn down, posters given mustaches, deflated Sonic balloons strewn throughout the lobby. Obviously, Race, or Race's guys, were behind this. But if Kalinske had any doubts, they vanished when he saw the hotel's pool, which was overflowing with large black balloons inscribed with the letters PSX. Kalinske looked at Race and shook his head. "I know it's a joke," he said. "But don't you think this one went a little too far? I don't really care, but between you and me, I don't need anything else lowering morale. They're just balloons." "Steve," Kalinske said, mustering all the patience he could find. "Please stop." "Tom," Race said, matching the pattern of his speech. "No." Race gave Kalinske another pat on the shoulder, then walked away. Later that evening, Race would prove to be a man of his word when he arranged for Sega's evening party to be overrun with thousands of napkins that said, "PSX welcomes Sega to CES." Kalinske shook his head and readied himself to lead his guys into their final consumer electronics show. But before turning around, he made sure to take a moment to put on a brave face. Kalinske wasn't the only one learning to perfect a brave face. Diane Fernassier had become quite skilled herself, although for entirely different reasons. She was 12 weeks pregnant, and didn't want to let anyone know because she was afraid that if people found out, she might lose her job. Not lose her job as in getting fired, she knew that wouldn't happen, especially not with Kalinske in charge, but slowly get looped out of plans, conversations, and strategies to the point that her value to Sega would drop to zero. Therefore, until the moment was right, she planned to hide the morning sickness, act slightly embarrassed to be gaining weight, and continue to accept drinks of alcohol and pour out the contents when nobody was looking. By the second week in February, though, she could no longer keep the secret. At her age, the pregnancy was already considered high risk, and those odds got even worse when she learned that she was having triplets. Not long after revealing the news, she went to see the doctor and found out that at least two of the triplets had passed away. She worried that this was her fault, because she had kept working at Sega, but the doctor assured her that this was not at all the case. In light of the circumstances, however, he recommended she get a week of bed rest. Although the doctor had confirmed that the miscarriages had nothing to do with work, Fernassier was filled with guilt. Yet still, even feeling that way, she wanted to work. If it had been any other job, she'd likely have exited a while back. But this was Sega. This was the company that had taught her to take, that had given her the life and career she had always hoped was possible. And with the current hardware transition and so much at stake, she felt particularly obliged to repay Sega. This was significant, because it demonstrated the unbending dedication that many felt toward Kalinske and the company. It's also significant because, in a nutshell, Fernassier's commitment touched upon the reason Kalinske hadn't left to go with Milken. If she hadn't given up, and neither had Ryo, Toyota, and so many others, then how the hell could he give up? After a week of bed rest, Fernassier went in to speak with Kalinske. She wanted to go back to work, but not quite yet and not full-time. She didn't know if something like that might be possible, or how that kind of arrangement might work, but if it interfered with any of her responsibilities, she promised to find a way to...
Diane, Kalinske said. Don't worry about any of that. Take all the time you need, I mean that. Whatever arrangement works for you, I'll make it work for us.
But what about...
Nope, Kalinske said, cutting her off. We're not even going to continue this conversation until you put to rest all that doubt. Whatever you need, I mean it.
Fernassier was touched, and relieved in a way that she hadn't been in months.
Thank you, Tom.
I mean this so incredibly sincerely. It's the least we could do, he said, staring at her until he was sure it sunk in.
Besides, you have to admit the timing works out not so bad with Mike joining us.
Mike was Mike Ribeiro, a marketing wunderkind from Hilton Hotels, who had recently joined SOA to fill Ed Volkwine's position and run the marketing department. For many who had been with Sega since the beginning of the decade and watched the company grow, Ribeiro's arrival symbolized the final piece of Sega's transformation from scrappy go-getter to just another company. This likely had much more to do with the timing of his arrival and the unwinnable situation that he had been thrust into than with his personality or talents. After all, Sega had plenty of candidates to choose from, at least among those Sony hadn't already gotten. But Ribeiro differed from his predecessors in one significant way. For him, it really could have been widgets. Through the years, some members of Sega's marketing team had loved playing video games, while others didn't really embrace the pastime, but regardless where anyone fell on the gamer spectrum, they all appreciated the art of product development. That's why even those who didn't like playing games loved selling them. They were selling stories, adventures, friends from an alternate reality. But for Ribeiro, all that really mattered was the marketing. In essence, he represented to those at Sega the same thing that Sega itself had represented to Nintendo. Style not only superseded substance, but it did so to the point that substance was almost moot. Normally, Kalinske considered a mentality like that dangerous, but when it came to Saturn, an inferior system in just about every way possible, this was exactly what Sega needed to make a final stand on Saturn Day.
You must cancel it, Nakayama advised Kalinske, while the two were at a steak restaurant in the Bay Area.
I don't think you understand what you're saying, Kalinske replied.
We must go sooner, he said, meaning to move up the launch of the Saturn.
Nakayama-san, Kalinske said, still trying to wrap his mind around this.
With all due respect, we've spent an uncountable amount of hours coordinating the launch of this new system, and it all hinges upon that release date.
No, Nakayama said, with something that resembled a pout.
He turned his attention to carving out a large piece of steak, seemingly losing interest in the conversation.
We can't just change our plans like that, Kalinske said.
How could Nakayama be blind to what was going on at SOA? Sony was coming, and not only did they have a better system, but they were aggressively poaching Kalinske's employees. Just days earlier, Sega had honored a third-party analyst named Kirby Fong as Employee of the Year. 24 hours later, he left for a higher-paying job at Sony.
Especially not with the new trade show only weeks away. We need to put our best foot forward.
That's what I am thinking, Nakayama said,
in a sweeter voice that seemed to indicate he believed they were now on the same page.
It makes for a perfect opportunity to launch our new Saturn.
Wait, you mean to actually launch it there?
Nakayama nodded slowly.
See? It's perfect.
Kalinske vehemently opposed this idea. It made absolutely no sense. But in the course of his explaining why launching at E3 would effectively kill Saturn in the United States, he started to see what had caused Nakayama to feel this way. SOJ had launched the Saturn on November 22, 1994, and thus far the result had been rather strong. With 170,000 systems sold on just the first day, the Saturn appeared well on its way to becoming Sega's most successful console in Japan. Why had the Saturn triumphed where the Mega Drive and Master System had not? One reason was certainly the software. Although only 5 titles were available at launch, one of them was Virtua Fighter, which was currently the most popular arcade game in Japan. Another reason for the success could be SOJ's rowdier and more aggressive advertising campaign. And another reason, the one Kalinske assumed Nakayama suddenly valued most,
was that Saturn had entered the market 2 weeks before Sony's PlayStation, which notably still outsold the Saturn.
With Genesis, we went first, Nakayama explained. And you have seen how we reaped this reward. We must embrace this opportunity and also do the same.
Nakayama-san, Kalinske said. I don't quite understand what's been going on over the past year, but up until now, I've gone along with the plan. This, however, just can't happen.
It is not for you to decide.
Yes, it is.
You must better understand the situation.
The conversation escalated, the same tone at different volumes, until Nakayama got up and walked down on Kalinske, who was left alone at the table. How can Nakayama be acting like this? Even in the past when they disagreed, Nakayama had always made efforts to compromise, or at least make it seem that way. But this time it was different. Or, maybe it wasn't. Maybe this was just the first time since the tide had turned that Kalinske refused to budge. Either way, if this was what Nakayama wanted, then this was what would happen. If Kalinske didn't launch the Saturn at E3, then he'd be replaced by someone who would. For a second, that didn't sound like such a bad fate. But he just wasn't ready to quit. The situation looked dire, but maybe, just maybe, Nakayama's way would work out. The Saturn had indeed been successful in Japan, so perhaps it wasn't such a bad system after all. And as he sat there alone in the restaurant, Kalinske suffered from the hidden problem that faces men of great inspiration. They can talk anyone into anything, even themselves. Chapter 62. Fork in the Road. All we are is a collection of moments, Kalinske thought, as he walked onto the stage at the Los Angeles Convention Center. It was May 11th, 1995, the world's very first electronic entertainment expo, and given how far he and those around him had come, it was hard not to feel nostalgic. Some of those moments are big, others small, and a few curiously change size over time. For this one, however, this milestone brimming with 41,000 fans and 420 exhibitors, it wasn't its size that really mattered, but merely the fact that it would be shared by all the right people, the forefathers of the video game industry. Their careers now spanned various points along the industry's spectrum, but they were all there. And that's what made this moment eternally special. People like Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari, who is now senior consultant for a small game developer called Playnet. Howard Phillips, Nintendo's former game master, who is currently in between jobs. And Michael Katz, who could have probably helped Phillips, as he had become one of the video game industry's first headhunters, with a particular penchant for moving employees from Sega to Sony. I'd like to take a moment, Kalinske began vibrantly, officially kicking off this groundbreaking event. Right at the beginning of my remarks to convey one of the more important pieces of news you're likely to hear while at E3. Tomorrow, May 12, 1995, will be Yogi Berra's birthday, his 70th. So we all need to prepare ourselves for a heavier-than-usual onslaught of Yogiisms from radio and TV commentators. If I may, I'd like to kick off the birthday observance by repeating my own personal favorite of his. When I come to a fork in the road, I take it. Now that's not only vintage Berra, Kalinske continued, but it's also good for kicking off speeches. It can even be construed without an awful lot of effort to be representative of what I'm about to say today. I am going to discuss choices. I am going to discuss change. There were about 30,000 people on hand for the inaugural show. Some were the forefathers, some were members of the industry's new generation, but most were just people from around the country who loved video games. The revolution had indeed been pixelated. Video games were not just a fad, not just for kids, but a source of art, story, and entertainment for anyone of any age at any time. E3 works as a pretty good symbol of some of the changes our industry is experiencing, Kalinske continued. Here's this great big show designed solely for interactive entertainment. CES, great success that it's been, was never really designed for us. It related better to an older culture. It forced some of the most creative companies on Earth to at least figuratively put on gray suits and, well, fit into a sort of TV-buying, furniture-selling mode. 20 years ago, this industry had not existed. 10 years ago, Kalinske had never thought he'd be a part of it.